Hello everyone and welcome to Coaches on the Couch. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Louise.
And today we're really pleased to be welcoming Carl Turner and Susie Winstanley, who are directors of Turner Works. How are you both?
Great, well. Thank you.
Great. So as usual, before we get into anything else, let's chat couches. Susie, let's come to you first. Please tell us something brief and interesting about your couch.
So my story is about the sofa that always gets stuck. My partner and I bought a very big sofa about 15 years ago, and we've never been able to get it through a doorway. So it first got stuck when it first got delivered, and we had to immediately hire one of those things that will take a big object up to a first floor window. We thought that was a feat, but then the next time we moved house, we realized again it wouldn't fit through the front door. So again, it had to go through the window. So at some point we should probably replace it, but for now we're very fond of it, and yes, that's my sofa story.
It will probably have to come out through the window in pieces if you ever move home again, and that will be heartbreaking.
That is the threat, yes.
And Carl, something about your couch?
Yeah, well, I've got a sort of mid-century modern Danish couch that my wife bought a couple of years ago, and we're serial renovators, so it's only 2 years old for us, although it's quite an old couch, and it's already had three homes already. So it's another story of a couch that's kind of moved around. And I think we've just moved into a place that we've been renovating ourselves and sitting on deck chairs and camping out, roughing it. And actually, when we go and visit our kind of couch and our furniture in the storage unit, and I think it's kind of weird, isn't it, how the sense of home relies so strongly on the objects and the things that have got meaning to you. And I think the day that we brought the couch in, we also had to bring it in through the front window of our very small house, was like a massive feeling of relief of actually we'd rediscovered our sense of self in a way. Even though it's a relatively new couch to us, but yeah, it's definitely style over function.
As long as it's not style over comfort, because you know comfort's quite important in a couch. And actually, that's a useful reminder of why that's always our first question and why we're called Coaches on the Couch. Because, as you probably know, it was a bit of a lockdown project when we were all getting a lot more familiar with the things in our home, and the couch or the sofa became a. Sofa doesn't work as an alliteration, so it had to be couch. Became synonymous with the little nests that we were all inhabiting for far too long. Anyway, moving on. So Turner Works describes itself as a new kind of architecture studio. In your words, you've grappled with shipping containers, car parks, and old agricultural buildings, and you've built spaces and places from scratch. And specific projects include Pot Brixton, which is somewhere that I know quite well. You've done some master planning for a shipping district in Norway, multi-story at Wood Wharf, Mount View Academy, and a number of homes, including the Mansa Medal award-winning Slip House.
And Carl, you founded the practice in 2006, and Susie, you joined from Panorama Prasad as co-director in 2019. And the thread for our conversation today is future fit. Yeah, we often coach leaders around how they can find time to think strategically for the future while also making sure the day-to-day needs of their clients and organisations are met.
And in our brief pre-chat, you mentioned that in the post-COVID period, you've been going through a bit of a rethink about the future of Turner Works. And there are many strands to that thread. But perhaps we'll start with a more general question to you both. What do you think it takes to be future fit as an architectural studio? And Susie, let's come to you first. What does that mean to you, that expression future fit?
I think that in architecture, you're just always evolving and always changing. So you can't really define yourself and then just sit on it. You always have to be looking for what problems we're going to need to solve next. So when we're working with our clients, sometimes they kind of want us to have done the exact same thing before, but more often they've got a new kind of problem to resolve with their project. So I feel like we have to be really nimble, and that if you just depend on everything that you've done before, it's not enough, you won't thrive. So yeah, I think it's just about being flexible and keeping evolving all the time and knowing that you're going to keep changing as you move forward.
Yeah. I read something this morning that talked about being able to look around the corner to identify blind spots before you actually reach them. Carl, what do you think of that? You're nodding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the maybe the hallmarks of the practice is that much of our work's been self-initiated, and that was driven largely through a frustration of not being able to find the clients or the developers that were doing the kind of work that we felt needed to be done. You know, working for communities that needed help rather than just thinking of projects as a vehicle for people to make money. So in a way, I think that idea of self-initiated projects is ingrained quite deeply in the practice and not sitting for the phone to ring. And yeah, it's about thinking about the problems that are out there, the broader problems in society, and thinking in, you know, quite a limited role that architects have these days about how we can solve those problems. And in many ways, the reimagining of our own practice when we moved from Carl Turner Architects, a fairly traditional small, you know, architecture practice doing smaller residential work, that was the ambition, calling ourselves Turner Works, dropping the word architect, that we actually felt was really holding back the practice because it actually limited the perception of what, you know, people think of architects in a particular role. And we wanted to do the bit before the architects and the bit after the architects. So everything from what might traditionally be called master planning, we've called it imagining or reimagining, up to the contracting and then the running or the operating of spaces, actually how you can run somewhere equitably, which is how kind of Pop Brixton came around, that kind of opportunity came about. So I think we are really different in the way that we think. And I think what we're trying to now think about, as you say, is what's around the next corner. And having driven the practice through a series of seminal projects and with Susie on board now, you know, what are the next problems for work, for the world, for the society that we've got the skill set to solve? And we're not going to figure that out by just waiting for projects to be handed to us. You know, in a way, we need to be on the ground working out what those problems are and then figuring out how we might help to solve them. And I think one of the ways that we've been doing that is by teaming up with lots of other, either smaller practices or where we're the smaller practice with larger practices, you know, more ambitious projects that need big teams to approach problems. And we can bring a different way of thinking often to those teams. So yeah, I think that's the future fit is, as you say, it's kind of second guessing about what the future holds, that kind of crystal ball, crystal gazing. But I think fundamentally the problem, society's problems are fairly similar from generation to generation. They don't actually change that much. They're just nuanced, you know, technology brings in new nuances, but fundamentally there's a lot of the same kind of issues that have been around for decades. So it's maybe not always that hard to figure out what might be coming because it's the same, but just a bit different.
Yeah, we have people who just can't get into that mindset when we're coaching. They can't imagine how they do that. And you talked about one way that you try and do that through collaboration with other practices. How else specifically do you go about trying to imagine the future and the problems that you might need to solve?
Well, yeah, I was going to say what we're often doing is getting a good collaborator to work with. So currently we're working with a potential operator of a space where they've come to us and they have a project that they want to do. So you could think of that as a client and think, oh, we can't take on that project. But actually what we've decided to do is think of it as a think piece. There's lots of open competitions for architects to do out there. There's so many things that you can spend your time doing free design on. And what we try to do is do it in a more strategic way. So by working with this potential operator, we're then able to come up with a design solution that we can then use as a way of thinking about some of these new problems and issues that we're talking about. And it's a new way, a different way for us to get in, talking to new potential clients and developers, and to talk to our current clients as well. Because I guess what we're always trying to bring to our current clients too is to share knowledge with them, to show them other examples of other work that we're doing. So that's another way that we bring in a kind of way of being innovative in practice.
It's collaboration, looking at innovation and looking for new opportunities. How do you de-risk in that? Does the collaboration de-risk it to some extent? Because I know that, you know, Pop Brixton, for example, that must have been a massive personal, I think it was a massive personal economic risk. How do you balance up the risk and the reward in getting involved in things that you're not absolutely sure are going to deliver profit anytime soon?
I think it's calculating what you can afford to lose. Also, there's the opposite side of that scale is what you might gain from that. So for me, Pot Brixton personally was, you know, a difficult conversation with my wife, Mary, long suffering, about selling our lovely award-winning home so that we could invest some cash into Pot Brixton to get it off the ground, and which is what we did. And the upside was that it was almost like I felt at the time it was a kind of last roll of the dice. I'd always wanted to work in the public realm, projects that made a difference to, you know, ordinary people, not just for people with lots of money. And it was an opportunity to really try out lots of things that I'd thought about for many years and believed in. But we didn't risk everything. So we put some money into it with the idea that we'd get the ball rolling, and then that would allow us to build confidence in the project and to bring in other investors. And, you know, I was also looking at that, those connections with developers and investors, as I could go to them and say, look, I'm not just an architect who wants to kind of show you my portfolio. I've got a potential project here. You could invest in it. It could be part of the story. This is a new way of developing sites, which is about a revenue-based model, about social value, about a completely different model, not about land ownerships, partnering with local authorities. And there's so many layers here. And, you know, eventually we teamed up with the collective and the whole thing kind of took off. So there was personal loss in that we sold our lovely home, which, you know, we're still kind of fairly transitory after that, because we've not really been able to find somewhere as lovely.
Storage. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, we, as a practice, it was the kind of the move, you know, taking that chance, that risk, that actually unlocked the practice and allowed the practice to move away from the kind of work that I'd felt like was really stuck in that kind of rut of residential work. There's nothing wrong with that work. It's just not what I personally wanted to do. And I'd kind of inadvertently ended up in that trap, as many small practices do. So, you know, that really unlocked huge potential for the practice, and, you know, ultimately led to us winning huge new public buildings like Mountview Academy. There was a direct link between Pot Brixton and Mountview because it built confidence and many other coincidences. But it was, you know, that risk was in hindsight worth taking, and I'd take it again, basically.
That's really good to hear. And presumably, you know, in terms of leadership, in order to do that and in order to bring people with you, you have to demonstrate your total confidence in something and bring people with you, but at the same time empower them to feel that they've got a part of that. And I was just interested because, Susie, you've joined Carl from a much bigger practice where your future could have been a lot more certain, I suppose, in some ways. Sorry, Carl, but possibly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But presumably, that sense of entrepreneurship and innovation is something that's inspired you as well.
Yeah, that's what I was hungry for and why I thought it was worth taking the risk. And it became such a strange time to join because of the pandemic and so on. So like a year into me being here, things were going really well. We were working on much bigger projects. I felt that the experience that I brought was super relevant because we were really going up in scale. And then the pandemic hit and it changed what our workload was. And it really, we had construction projects on at the same time as well. So because we had to change a lot, I had to be really flexible, super agile in how I responded to those new challenges. So I still had to lead throughout that and lead by example, show people that we needed to take on other tasks within the studio, just all pull together to get ourselves through some of the challenges that were happening. I feel like because of that, I've kind of earned my stripes and now actually really understand this way of working and can give a lot more back because of that. So I think in the next phase, all of those things will come together to mean that it's a really good phase for the practice. I'm looking forward to that.
How is it, Susie, to join a practice with a founding director and come in as a co-director? But how is that? What are the challenges?
It is a really interesting process. So obviously when I came here, I needed to work out what the practice most needed. And I needed to understand that from all the people that were here, so from Carl and then from all the other members of the team. I needed to figure out who in the team where each person was at and what was the impact of them of having a new leader. Because obviously I'd been at Panorama Facade for a really long time. So I'd been working with people and I'd recruited people, and there was a lot of respect and for me, because I'd mentored a lot of people and work, they knew the work that I'd done. But here I was totally new. So in a way I had to prove myself, but I had to do that not just for myself, but kind of for the good of the practice, so that the challenges to kind of come in and be genuinely really for the practice, for the projects, and genuinely helpful to the practice in order for the practice to thrive. So yeah, it's a delicate balance. I think you have to be a really flexible person to do that well, but I also think that you have to be very aware of your own worth and ability in order to be able to say, where can I make the most difference. Yeah, there's all sorts of things within that, and I think it takes time, and I think it also depends on the incumbent director. So for Carl, he has been very open to me finding my feet and finding a shape for myself in the practice. I don't feel that he's dictated it. And it's changing all the time. So as we've got used to working together and know each other better and have tested a few things out, I think that we've both been really open to seeing what works best for the practice overall.
I'm just wondering, Carl, how the decision to bring in a co-director relates to future fit.
Yeah, it's an evolving relationship. And, you know, I think I only realised how lonely at the top and isolated I was when Susie came along. And, you know, the thought of her not being there now in the practice is quite horrific. And it's not because we haven't got other leaders in the practice and that there's not a sharing of responsibility, but there's something different about being a director, having your neck on the block and, you know, having that person to share a kind of visioning process with. I think when you're a single leader, you always it always tends to be you who's kind of setting the tone and the pace, and you know, people kind of go along with it to a certain extent. But I think you know, the practice is in a much better position now. Susie was able to bring a level of attention to detail and professionalism, and quite frankly, Susie's people skills are kind of way more advanced than mine in many ways, and she's used to working in a bigger practice with more people. So it's been a huge benefit to the practice. And, you know, there's no surprise that we've been winning more and better projects and been able to manage more work and deliver it more effectively because Susie's been able to systemize the way that we do things. So it's been incredibly powerful and liberating. And yeah, you know, I think it's transformed the practice, really.
That's a really heartwarming story to hear without being all schmaltzy about it. But as you say, it can be quite lonely at the top. And also, if you've built it from the ground up, as you have, Carl, to have somebody come in with big practice experience, just to give that totally new perspective, I can imagine how welcome that was. And as Rachel was alluding to, presumably that was part of your future fit thinking, that this was the next stage of evolution for you.
Yeah, definitely. I recognised that I couldn't really continue without getting some more help. And, you know, we find time to think about the structure of the practice, the kind of work we want to do, the type of clients we want to work for or with. And that's constantly evolving. And I think the pandemic threw a huge spanner in the works and we went into survival mode. We slightly went into our shells a bit, like many people probably did. We lost a really massive contract, which was a game changer for us. And then we kind of did it for a few months and then we lost it. So that was a real bitter blow. But, you know, we've come out of the other side of the pandemic. We're still winning lots of work, which is really good. And I think we've got a genuinely different approach. And I think just talking about leadership down through the practice, I think one of the problems that we have as architects, I think, is that we've almost have it kind of trained into us that we shouldn't step outside our core skill set, and that it's kind of risky to take on challenges or projects that you're not experienced in. And I mean, if I heeded that advice, I wouldn't be where I am now. And I've taken the opposite track of actually thinking, you know, I can expand into other people's territory and do a good job and hopefully prove that that's true. And I think what that means for our younger team is that they are constantly worried and, you know, outside of their comfort zone, that we're asking them to tackle areas that maybe they don't feel is kind of core to an architect's skill. So I think Susie's been great at trying to support and mentor the team around those kind of skill sets. I can be slightly less patient with people than Susie is, because I'm kind of focusing on the bigger picture and trying to, you know, step towards bigger goals. And it's trying to have a team structure that can keep up with the ambition of what we want to do. And I also make huge mistakes. You know, I've led us down some fairly destructive paths in the last couple of years that, you know, where I've potentially stepped into something that hasn't worked out. But, you know, that's the other side of taking risks. It doesn't always work out.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. I mean, I was coaching somebody this morning who was saying that they tend to see the downside of things and they'd like to be able to see more of the upside. I'm just wondering how you would advise that person, Carl. You obviously do the opposite.
I mean, I'm naturally optimistic, which is good that it drives you in a direction, but yeah, it can lead you to make mistakes and to overstep, you know, kind of limits. But I mean, I try and break things down into really simple steps, I think, are the bigger goal. And I think, does that align with our kind of vision or the vision at that point? Is it the direction of travel we want to go in? Is it worth the risk? And then if I think it is worth the risk, then it's about breaking it down into smaller pieces and thinking, actually, it's not that much more than a project that we've taken on before. You know, we do have skill sets. We've got skill sets which could be aligned or slightly modified. And it's about, you know, having that kind of stepping stone approach to problem solving, I think, rather than just focusing on the fact that it's kind of bigger and scarier than anything you've maybe done before. And I also think because I had I built lots of things at small scale. So I was a small, you know, design and build contractor effectively for many years. And I think back to that mentality of fail early, fail cheap, which is something that was drilled into us at the RCA where I studied, kind of a product design approach where you test at small scale. So in many ways, I just see bigger projects, whether they're master plans or big buildings, they're just kind of a scaled up version of the same lessons that we learned at small scale. So effectively, even though we may not have tackled a project of a certain type or scale, I feel like I've got the building blocks to tackle it because it's probably just the same problem, but just multiplied.
I think that background in product design probably answers a lot of questions about your attitude towards being, as you say, testing and being pushed outside of your comfort zone. And I'm just wondering, Susie, you know, as Carl says, architects can be trained in a particular way and can feel, a lot of people feel less comfortable with being pushed outside of their comfort zone. How do you make people feel comfortable with being outside of their comfort zone?
So I try and lead by example, really. I try and show people that, and explain to them that we're able to transfer our skills across. So I trained at the RCA as well, just after Carl. And the attitude there was definitely, it's not just about building. There's not, the answer that you think is not necessarily the answer that is the only answer. And so when I'm working with the team, I kind of try and recognize where they're coming from, because they're often just really keen to be able to design a building, use the skills that they've got. And also because architecture is such a long training and so on, it can feel like a very long time till you realize your first building. And then once you've done a few, it becomes easier to be a bit more flexible about what the outcome of a project is. But I just try and show the team the value in thinking in a different way, show them that it is possible to do more things than the Reba job book tells you, and that it's quite simple, really. And it's about speaking a language that isn't super architecture jargon. So it's about talking to real people and real clients who are not using all those complex architectural terms and words, and just making it all feel quite a lot more simple and familiar.
I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to bring the conversation gradually to a close. I've got a really sort of practical question to possibly end up with. Louise might have another question, but we're just going to... A lot of people struggle with the time, you know, how you balance the time. There's a lot going on day to day. How do you balance that? We're trying to look forward. How do you each do that?
we do. We both try and put time aside to have those conversations with each other and also with the team. It does go in cycles. So when we get really busy, maybe it drops off a bit. But I think having that time to work on the designing the business that you want to be in the future is so important. And I wish that I'd been coached in those kind of techniques and thoughts when I was much younger, and I probably wouldn't have spent so long going around in circles. But actually, you know, applying design to your own business, and it's obviously easy to say, if you need to earn money, you tend to take on work and it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think, yeah, blocking out time. I mean, at the moment, we're sort of blocking out, you know, we want to think about money, the culture, the vision, systems. So we're trying to have four or five subjects that me and Susie are just constantly tinkering with, like graphs and charts and lists. Susie just started hosting some internal discussions with the team about visioning for the future. And I think we're thinking post-pandemic, we've got to a certain place, like what's our next kind of milestone as a practice. And I think, you know, slightly worryingly, but also kind of in a way that's very freeing, I have no actual personal idea where we're going to be in 5 years. I can't really see that vision at the moment. And I think we just have to get there through a series of discussions. So, and I think for me, it's really important that Susie really is leading in that process, because, you know, I'm a bit older than Susie, and I think it's time that Susie needs to sort of really have a really strong say in that vision. I feel like I've scratched the itch that I had in sort of moving from a resi architect to somebody doing kind of public projects. And so for me, I've kind of achieved a lot of what I felt like I wanted to personally. And I think, so we're asking the team, how do you see the vision? And I guess what my challenge to the team is, it just needs to be bold, and it needs to be a little bit out there, because inevitably it always gets reined in. So let's think big about what we could do, and then think about what the practical application is. But yeah, there's no real trick to it. It's just planning in time and doing it systematically. And we've just started a process of that internally, because we realized it got a bit difficult through COVID, because we were not face to face, and we felt there was so much extra time we spent trying to keep the ship afloat remotely that actually we did let it slip a little bit.
I love the idea of applying design to your own business. I think that's a really good lesson for leaders of other practices. And Susie, how would you answer the same question?
To balance time, definitely, it's all about time blocking. I mean, I literally tell myself at the beginning of a day or the beginning of a week what I'm going to be doing that week, and then I follow it, and I vary it if I need to. But I actually think that is a top tip for being effective. It means that not only do I know what I'm going to be doing, but I know what I did as well. So I've got it kind of written down. In terms of developing the future of the practice, I kind of feel like we've got a much more stable vehicle, kind of full of fuel, ready for the next leap. So we've gone through a process of taking a lot of the agile thinking from Meanwell projects, so how you activate space in the short term. And then we've started to apply that on a bigger scale. And that was something that I was really interested in seeing us achieve. We've done that in the last couple of years. Now I think it's about applying some of those same techniques on a kind of bigger range of projects and going up to a bigger scale. We worked on an £80 million project together in the practice, and it was really interesting to see how this small team could apply the same kind of thinking and approach to a really big project. Big projects can be quite boring. They go on for quite a long time, and they can be quite full of nitty gritty. So it is kind of exciting to see actually how you can make that process different. One of the things Carl is really good at is standing back and pointing out something that can sound really simple, but is actually a big, bold idea. And so there is a tradition of that in practice. So when we say about the future vision, it's about saying, oh, what do we want to be next? Are we the biggest, the boldest, the smartest, the most flexible, whatever? So that's the kind of process and the journey that I'm hoping to take the team here on as well. I've realized that it's really critical and really makes a difference when we work on the business. So in the last 2 years, I don't think we've had the time to do that. It's felt like firefighting. So we've managed to get through and deliver projects, and some of them have been super interesting. But we've not really had time set aside to say for 2 hours today, I'm working on the business. And I feel like if we do that every day, as we're trying to do it now, then that will make a super powerful difference to where the business is going to be in the next few years and looking far ahead as well.
It is that prioritization, isn't it?
Yeah. You've just got to make yourself do it.
Yeah, I was coaching somebody this morning on time blocking. And it's, you know, and I have another client who will write down her three key priorities for the week and then go through her diarying and cancel meetings that aren't going to help her meet those priorities by the end of the week. And so there's another useful tip there on prioritizing and time management. And these things sound so straightforward and easy, and you could get them from a textbook, but until you've tried them in practice, you don't know how impactful they can be.
Absolutely. Okay, and I think that brings us to a close. That was a really interesting and useful tour through Future Fit at Turner Work. So, yeah, thanks so much for your time, Carl, Susie. That was great.
And good luck with the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll be back.
Yeah, we'll continue looking into our crystal ball.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
See you.
Thank you.